Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, HDL-C and Aim High. Does increasing HDL-C reduce cardiovascular risk? Which is certified by Medscape and presented by Michael H. Davidson, MD, Peter P. Toth, MD, PhD, and William E. Bowden, MD. Dr. Davidson is a clinical professor of medicine, director, preventive cardiology, Pritzker School of Medicine, the University of Chicago, Chicago, Illinois. Dr. Davidson has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Amgen, Merck & Company, Roche, and Sanofi Aventis. He owns stock options, or bonds from Omthera Pharmaceuticals. Dr. Davidson does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Davidson does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Toth is a director of preventive cardiology, CGH Medical Center, Sterling, Illinois, clinical professor, University of Illinois College of Medicine, Peoria, Illinois. Dr. Toth has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Abbott Laboratories, AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Atherotech Diagnostics Lab, Genentech, Genzyme Corporation, Coa Company, and Merck & Company. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Abbott Laboratories, AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, GlaxoSmithKline, Coa Company, Merck & Company, Pfizer, and Takeda Pharmaceuticals North America. Dr. Toth does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Toth does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Bowden is a clinical chief, Division of Cardiovascular Medicine, Professor of Medicine and Preventive Medicine, School of Public Health and Health Professions, University of Buffalo, the State University of New York, Medical Director, Cardiovascular Services, Kaleida Health, Chief of Cardiology, Buffalo General and Millard Fillmore Hospitals, Buffalo, New York. Dr. Bowden has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Abbott Laboratories, CardioDX, Gilead Sciences, and Sanofi Aventis. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Abbott Laboratories and Gilead Sciences. He received grants for clinical research from Abbott Laboratories. Dr. Bowden does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Bowden does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to educate clinicians on the latest HDL-C clinical trials in the prevention of atherosclerotic disease in at-risk patients. This activity is supported by Hoffman LaRoche. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, my name is Michael Davidson, clinical professor of medicine, director of preventive cardiology at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. I'd like to welcome you to this exciting panel. We're going to discuss HDL cholesterol and AIM-HI. Does increasing HDL cholesterol reduce cardiovascular risk? Today I'm joined by two good friends and colleagues. I think no two better people to discuss this issue than Peter Toth, Director of Preventive Cardiology at the Sterling Illinois Professor of Medicine, University of Illinois College of Medicine, and Bill Bowden, Clinical Chief, Division of Cardiovascular Medicine, Professor of Medicine and Preventive Medicine at the University of Buffalo. We have a lot of new data coming in about HDL cholesterol, especially the AIM-HI trial. It has been a disappointing study, but a very important trial to discuss in detail. The value of raising HDL has been something that we're questing for a long time, to reduce cardiovascular risk. And this study does give us a lot of new information that we want to try to put in perspective for clinicians. So, Peter, let me start with you. You're on the front lines in family practice, out there preventing heart disease on a regular basis. Let's set the stage for why we Bill led one of the leaders of the AIM-HI trial, and what is HDL cholesterol. Low levels mean, and what is the potential for raising HDL cholesterol to reduce cardiovascular risk?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. And actually, HDL is probably one of the most fascinating areas in current preventive medicine, because we know that worldwide, when you look at prospective epidemiologic studies in both men and women, if HDL is low, risk is greatly magnified for future cardiovascular events. The lower it goes, the higher the risk. On the opposite side of the coin, as HDL is high, the higher it goes, the lower the risk. And we also know that this is true for people of all racial and ethnic groups evaluated to date. So what is it about HDL that makes it so different? And obviously, we've learned in the last few years that its protein cargo, its proteasome, is highly varied, very complex, up to 75 different proteins, apoproteins, enzymes, globulins, even complement components. This allows HDL particles to participate in a broad variety of anti-atherogenic type phenomena, including reverse cholesterol transport, the process by which HDL particles can interact with lipid-laden macrophages in the subendothelial space, mobilize intracellular cholesterol, promote its externalization, and deliver this excess cholesterol back to the liver for disposal. In addition, it exerts a broad variety of protective phenomena for endothelial cells, reverses endothelial cell dysfunction. It's antioxidative, antithrombotic. There's a lot of things it does that appear to be protective. So when we look at AIM-HI and try to put this study in some context, historically, has there been evidence that a drug like niacin, which currently is the best drug for raising HDL, does it reduce risk for heart events? And the answer has been yes. In fact, when we look at the Coronary Drug Project, first initiated in the late 60s, reported out back in the mid-70s, 3 grams of niacin daily in men with established coronary disease actually did reduce risk for MI and stroke by 26 and 24% respectively. Now, it took a longer period of follow-up, namely 11 years, to see a reduction in mortality, but it was observed. Now, subsequently, when they look at niacin in combination with other drugs, namely statins or bile acid-binding resins, or even more complex combinations, up to 3 drugs, you see outsized risk reduction. And we see this in the familial atherosclerosis treatment study. And notably, we also saw it in the high-density lipoprotein atherosclerosis treatment study, the HATS trial. In addition, in AFREGS, once again, complex combinations of niacin with gemfibrozil and a bile acid-binding resin, above 50% relative risk reduction in heart events. So niacin, historically, either as monotherapy or when used in combination, most certainly reduced risk for heart events. Now, how about for HDL in general? Well, when you do meta-analyses, even with statin trials, in fact, you can see a signal for risk reduction based on magnitude of HDL elevation. And it appears that the best way to define capacity to either induce plaque regression or reduce events is going to be a combination of LDL reduction and HDL elevation. In VA-HIT, we saw that raising HDL did significantly contribute to overall risk reduction in a trial using gemfibrozil in men with established coronary disease. And I think a little known piece of information emerged from the Beza Fibrate Infarction Prevention Study, BIP. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, in that trial, for every 5 mg/dL prospectively over 7.9 years of follow-up on therapy, mortality was reduced by 27%. And I think that's pretty significant. So I think that laid down the path for researchers to ask the question, if we do a large trial and using current standards of care and randomize patients to a drug that raises HDL significantly or treat them with placebo, are we going to see a difference in events?
Yeah.
And that's where Aim High comes in.
All right, Bill. You were one of the leaders of the Aim High trial, so why don't you give us the study design and talk about the data.
I think Peter's done a magnificent job of providing an overview of the topic. And what we really sought to do with Aim High was to to confront head-on this issue of residual risk, because we accept the fact that statins have been the cornerstone of lipid-altering therapy for the last decade, and there's an abundance of primary and secondary prevention studies to support that. We reasoned that in patients who had low levels of HDL, that there might be an opportunity to see if we could further mitigate risk by increasing low levels of HDL, reducing triglycerides in the setting of optimally controlled LDL. So really that was the goal that underlied the Aim High trial. The hypothesis was very simply that the co-administration of high-dose extended-release niacin when added to intensive LDL-lowering therapy would be superior to LDL-lowering therapy alone in reducing the risk of cardiovascular events in patients who had established non-acute atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease and low levels of baseline HDL cholesterol. Very briefly, the entry criteria are summarized here. Patients, men and women who were 45 years of age or older, who had documented CHD, cerebrovascular disease, or peripheral arterial disease, qualified on the basis of that clinical criterion. And then in addition, patients had to meet fairly stringent inclusion criteria with respect to dyslipidemia. That is to say, they had to have, for men, HDLs less than 40 mg/dL, for women less than 50. Triglycerides in a range from 150 to 400 milligrams per deciliter, and LDLs below 180. The study design is very simply shown here, proceeding from left to right. You can see that prior to the double-blind randomized phase of the study, all patients entered into an open-label run-in phase for 4 to 8 weeks, where we began a rapid uptitration of extended-release niacin beginning in week one with 500 milligrams, co-administered with simvastatin 40 milligrams, and then at weekly intervals we increase the niacin dose by 500 milligrams to a peak dose of 2 grams per day. In order for patients to qualify, they had to tolerate at least 1,500 milligrams of niaspan without unacceptable side effects, at which point they then were randomized to either extended-release niacin in the dose that they tolerated, combined with 40 to 80 milligrams of simvastatin, so this was the combination dyslipidemia group, versus placebo plus simvastatin. And again, importantly, in the placebo tablets, they were spiked with a small 50 milligram dose of immediate-release niacin, sufficient to impart a mild flush, so as to preserve the masking of the identity of treatment to both the participants and the patients. You'll see that the goal was to achieve and maintain on-treatment LDL in the range of 40 to 80 milligrams per deciliter. The reason that we picked this goal is that this is contemporary with evolving practice, which is that many studies have shown the benefits of LDL in the range of less than 70, and it was our goal to achieve those levels of LDL control, but the expectation was that we would see incremental benefit of HDL raising on top of that. So in essence, a total of 4,275 patients began the run-in, and of that, 80% were randomized. A total of 3,414 patients entered into the double-blind phase of the trial. The primary outcome measure for AIM-HI was a five-component time-to-first event that included coronary heart disease death, non-fatal infarction, ischemic stroke, hospitalization for acute coronary syndrome, and symptom-driven revascularization. We had three pre-specified secondary composite endpoints, one of which was CHD death, non-fatal MI, ischemic stroke, and hospitalization for high-risk ACS, and then the triple component of CHD death, non-fatal MI, and ischemic stroke. This was an event-driven trial, and so we projected that we would need 800 adjudicated primary outcome events during a 2.5 to 7 year follow-up. And we projected that this would result in a 4.6-year mean follow-up. We had 85% power to detect a 25% reduction in the five-component primary endpoint. And there were also very conservative pre-specified asymmetric boundaries for potential early stopping based on either efficacy or lack of efficacy. As I think is now well known, in late May, the DSMB noted that there was no statistically significant difference in the primary outcome measure for the two groups. And somewhat unexpectedly, it was observed that there was an increased number of ischemic strokes in the niacin-treated patients. For that reason, the DSMB recommended to the NHLBI that the study be stopped approximately 18 months earlier than planned. And so what I'll be sharing with you are the data from the mean 36-month follow-up. Very quickly, the baseline characteristics show that this was a group of patients who were on average age 64. These were overwhelmingly men, 85%, and Caucasian, 92%. And they had significant baseline cardiovascular risk factors, 71% with hypertension, a third with diabetes, and importantly, 81% had metabolic syndrome, 56% had had a prior infarction. This is really important. You can see the concomitant medications at entry. 94% of the patients in AIM high were on a statin at the time of randomization. And of that group, 76% had been on a statin for at least a year, and 40% of these patients had been receiving a statin for 5 or more years. Additionally, 20% of patients had previously received niacin and then washed out prior to their inclusion in the study. And again, you'll see that the use of secondary prevention therapies was robust by contemporary standards and applied equally to both arms of the trial. Here, I think, is a very important slide because it really distinguishes the differential lipid profiles observed in the 94% of patients on a statin as compared with the 218 patients, or 6% of patients, off statin. In the on-statin-treated patients at entry, you'll see that the LDL was very low at 71 milligrams per deciliter, the HDL 35, triglycerides 161. Note also the very low non-HDL, 107, and the ApoB of 81. These were incredibly well-treated patients. And quite frankly, that's the kind of lipid profile that you would not necessarily consider using a drug like niacin for.
I agree.
And if you contrast that with the smaller subset of patients off statin, this is more typical of what we see, I think, in clinical practice. Higher levels of LDL, lower levels of HDL, much higher levels of triglycerides, non-HDL of 165 and an ApoB of 111. So very contrasting lipid profiles. The average dose of simvastatin in both arms was about 40 milligrams. You can see that 50% in each group were receiving that dose. And there were statistically more people in the simvastatin monotherapy group that were receiving the 80 milligram dose of simvastatin. Now, also, in order to maintain and achieve these levels of on-treatment LDL between 40 and 80 milligrams, we recognize that not all patients would be able to achieve that with simvastatin. And so we did make available in both arms, as needed, the use of ezetimibe 10 milligrams daily to achieve those LDL on-treatment goals. And you'll see that there was a statistically higher occurrence of ezetimibe co-administration in the monotherapy group as compared with the combination dyslipidemia therapy group. The next three slides are very quickly the serial changes in HDL. So HDL for the population as a whole increased from 35 milligrams per deciliter at baseline to 42 milligrams per deciliter at year one, and that was maintained throughout the course of follow-up in the combination dyslipidemia therapy group. Somewhat unexpectedly, we saw an increase in HDL in the placebo-treated patients. That is to say, from 35 to somewhere between 38 and 39 milligrams per deciliter. It was actually 39 milligrams per deciliter in year one, 38 in years two and three. So that means that the net difference in HDL on treatment between the two groups was about 5 milligrams per deciliter for HDL. There was a significant decline, as expected, in triglycerides from a mean of 164 down to 122. You can see that in the yellow line. And that was maintained again throughout the follow-up period, and very negligible changes in triglyceride in the placebo-treated patients. And LDL was reduced from 74 at baseline for the entire population down to 62 milligrams per deciliter, and was maintained throughout the follow-up. And there was about a roughly 4 or 5% reduction in LDL in the placebo-treated patients, or if you will, the monotherapy group. So if we look then at the primary and secondary endpoints here, you can see that the hazard ratio for the primary endpoint was 1.02 with 95% confidence intervals that breached the unity boundary. And the secondary endpoints for the triple and the four-component endpoint are shown, all of which were directionally similar to the primary outcome measure. So none of these were statistically significant. And here we see the Kaplan-Meier curves. It'll be difficult to discern yellow from red. Yellow is the combination dyslipidemia therapy group, and red is the patients who received only LDL reduction therapy. And they're absolutely superimposed over the course of up to 4 years of follow-up, again, with a hazard ratio of 1.02 and a non-significant p-value. The secondary endpoints are shown here, and again, you can see for all the components of the primary and secondary outcomes, no statistically significant differences. But I do want to highlight the fact that ischemic stroke, the third line there on the slide, shows that the p-value was 0.11. That is to say, after all the events were adjudicated and reviewed, we could not discern that there was statistically significant stroke imbalance or excess in the niacin-treated patients. And there were six pre-specified groups based on age, sex, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, prior MI, and statin use at entry. Again, you'll note that the point estimates all hug the unity boundary, and none of these are statistically different. So I would say there then that to conclude that among patients with stable non-acute cardiovascular disease who were able to achieve and maintain rather rigorous on-treatment LDL levels of less than 70 milligrams per deciliter, that is, we had patients who achieved a level of 62 milligrams per deciliter, we could not demonstrate incremental clinical benefit of the addition of niacin to statin therapy during a 36-month follow-up, despite the expected and significant improvements in both HDL and triglycerides. I would say, obviously, the results from AIM-HI do, I think, answer a critical question that we really did not have the answer to, which is, in the setting of patients with optimally controlled LDL, you know, is there evidence that HDL raising with niacin would mitigate that risk? And we were unable to do that or to demonstrate that. And then lastly, I believe that our results reaffirm current NSAP-ATP3 treatment guidelines that LDL lowering remains the principal target of therapy. And obviously, there will be many, many more analyses forthcoming in the months to come from AIM-HI. We'll be able to get into various lipid sub-analyses to see if we can determine or identify any subsets of patients, like you mentioned in BIP, who might benefit from the combination of niacin and simvastatin.
Thanks, Bill. I mean, it's a very important study that was done, and it addressed a question that we're all wrestling with on a regular basis. So the basic conclusion is we still treat to goals based on present guidelines. That doesn't change anything that we're doing. We can use niacin, we can use ezetimibe, higher dose statin to achieve those goals. We don't see any difference between those approaches. So that's kind of the conclusion. There are those that are Monday morning quarterbacking. I'm not one of those because I was touting the great design of this trial before it came out. So it's hard to say it was not designed well. And it had a lot of interesting features that you had to put in the study because of the blinding issue about the pretreatment to make sure that people could tolerate the niacin, the using the low-dose niacin, which did, in fact, seem to raise HDL as well.
Right.
Those things seem to mitigate some of the lipid benefits between the two arms.
Right.
And then the power of the study is going to be criticized. Was it powered sufficiently? Because in coronary drug project, the lines don't diverge, you know, for 2 or 3 years. What do you say to the critics about the study design itself?
The study design was really predicated on seeing if the results of HATS could be replicated in a large multi-center trial. Clearly, in that study, there was a significant regression in coronary atherosclerosis, as well as a reduction in clinical events. And so what we really attempted to discern with AIM-HI is whether we could demonstrate in a group of patients with low HDL, in whom we thought there was significant residual risk, that there was incremental benefit of adding niacin on top of a background of optimally controlled LDL using both simvastatin and ezetimibe. Now, many have said, well, why did you get LDL down so low? It was an HDL-raising trial. Well, because that's exactly where the field has evolved toward using more aggressive LDL reduction.
And I would have to argue that there was absolutely no possibility of Bill's crew reproducing HATS, because HATS started out with an LDL of 124, mm-hmm. HDL 31. Here, you're starting out with an LDL of 71, non-HDL 107, with a very substantial percentage of patients already chronically aggressively treated.
Right.
Look at the intensity of the background therapy.
Exactly.
Even the diabetics, yeah, who made up 34% of the population,
right,
A1C of 6.6.
Yeah.
Show me another,
yeah,
cardiovascular trial where they had this intensity,
right,
of background therapy and this level of goal achievement.
That's right.
You,
yeah,
won't find one.
Yeah, and so therefore it raises the obvious question, or begs the obvious question, of how generalizable or reflective are the patients actually enrolled in AIM-HI to what we see in contemporary practice today in 2011, 2012?
And I would have to say, based on numbers available in the literature, not only for levels of LDL, non-HDL goal attainment in high and very high-risk patients as you enrolled in AIM-HI, but also just looking at the percentage of high and very high-risk patients who are on ARB-ACE, mm-hmm, beta blocker, aspirin, thianopyridine, and
yeah,
the diabetics who were seeing,
yeah,
multiple anti-glycemics, this study is probably generalizable to somewhere between 12 and 15% of the currently treated population of CAD patients,
yeah,
in the U.S., and
right,
probably fewer in other parts of the world.
Yeah, okay. And if you look at the previous studies that have looked at dyslipidemia therapy, certainly from an earlier era, you know, I think one of the things that we've learned from trials like COURAGE and BARI-2D is that as you continue to use more and more aggressive secondary prevention therapies, and then if intensive statin therapy is a principal part of that, as it was in AIM-HI, it gets increasingly more difficult to demonstrate incremental benefit on top of such a background of intensive treatment.
I think the fact that niacin alone reduced risk, like you mentioned, Peter, does that put it in a different category still than other therapies like ezetimibe? So let's go through the new secondary AHA guidelines. They still get the goal less than 70 is reasonable. I think AIM-HI supports getting,
mm-hmm,
below,
yeah,
70 non-HDL. Below 100. Now, so now you have a patient who's already at goal. It doesn't seem to matter whether you use add niacin. It doesn't seem to help, mm-hmm, those kind of patients. But I think most commonly you have patients that are not yet at goal,
mm-hmm, right,
that are above 70 LDL or they're above 100 non-HDL. Does it change anything as far as selection of therapy in your mind, Peter, as far as where you want to go with that patient?
I think I would most certainly abide by the results of AIM-HI for patients who are at this level of control in terms,
yeah,
of the risk factor burden. But if someone still has residual risk from high triglycerides, low HDL,
mm-hmm,
they're not intensively treated enough because either their LDL or non-HDL is not,
yeah,
at goal,
right,
I would not hesitate to use niacin in,
right,
a patient like that. But which agent I select, of course, is going to depend on the very, very brass knuckle specifics of the lipid profile. Would I use ezetimibe? Would I use niacin? Would I use fenofibrate? It just depends. But this trial does not eliminate niacin from my armamentarium.
No. And if you look at the small subset of 218 patients who are not receiving a statin at entry, they had exactly the kind of lipid profile in which we would consider using additional therapy. They had a baseline LDL of 119, triglycerides of 215, HDL of 32, and elevated levels of both non-HDL and ApoB. you know, a very important point you made a bit earlier, Peter, was the contrast in where we started out with LDL. If you look at VA HIT, the initial baseline LDL was 111, mm-hmm. you know, and we're starting out essentially 40 milligrams per deciliter lower, you know, on the background of statin treatment. So clearly differences.
Yeah. And the other thing about HATS was, remember, it was a placebo-controlled trial.
Yeah,
this
right.
is an active comparator study. So we want to make sure we don't compare apples to oranges, but there are profound differences yes. between HATS and AIM-HI.
So the bottom line is that if a patient already well-treated, it doesn't seem to matter to raise HDL, at least with niacin, as a therapeutic approach. Still, niacin is an option to get people to goal when they are not at goal yet.
Yes.
That's because I think we agree with that as a way to go based on this trial. So let's talk about...
And that's not guesswork, because we know from other studies that it is, in fact, efficacious and beneficial.
As a single...
But those other studies had very different baseline parameters when treatment was initiated.
Right. And that's consistent with the new secondary prevention guidelines by AHA and ACCF, yeah. that we still want to get to goal, use a multiple therapies if necessary to achieve that. Optimally, start off with statins and titrate to the highest dose of the statin and consider adding right. drugs as needed.
Michael, I'd like to return briefly to one comment that you made earlier about, was the study powered appropriately for what we set out to achieve? If you look at the Kaplan-Meier curves, they were spot on. They were absolutely superimposed, you know, over up to a 4-year follow-up. And the lower 95% confidence boundary of 0.87 means that we excluded up to a 13% benefit with niacin. So I don't think it's fair to criticize the study as being underpowered. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the study was appropriately powered. And again, the big question in my mind is the fact that we had only a 36-month follow-up. What would have been the likelihood had the study gone to completion or longer? That, like in VA HIT and CDP, we saw late separation in the treatment effect of those interventions.
Right, I think that it's reassuring the stroke signal that you showed us was not significant, and a lot of it was
right.
led by people off niacin for a while, too,
right.
the rates
so,
of stroke.
If you just look at the folks on niacin, it was only 21 to 18.
That's
reassuring. I think we're not seeing any safety issues. So the bottom line is get to goal as we see in the AIM-HI trial. Those people... do fairly well. The event rates are still high. We still have work to go when it comes to reducing residual risk, and we have new therapies on the horizon. We have other trials coming up in the near future. So we'll be able to look at specifically HDL raising therapies with CETP inhibition. We have other niacin trial, HBS2 Thrive.
HBS2 Thrive is still out there.
So I think stay
That's
tuned.
A much larger study.
A much larger study.
Stay tuned. It's also looking at niacin. As an agent, as opposed to the HDL raising effect of niacin.
Correct.
So that's
right.
that's a difference between the studies that's important to distinguish.
And I think we also need to emphasize that niacin is still the only drug currently available that not only has the greatest efficacy for raising HDL, barring the introduction of new HDL raising agents, but it also reduces Lp(a), drops triglycerides, decreases LDL, reduces LDL particle number,
yeah, right.
and also reduces non-HDL and VLDL.
Right. And so, and Peter, for those very important reasons, I think that we would be remiss if we didn't really emphasize the importance of this drug and that we should not really abandon its use. I think what we can say from the results of AIM-HI is in a very selected population, you know, who were extremely well treated, that we could not demonstrate the benefit of niacin. And therefore, in that group, if you can achieve those levels, there's no reason to consider using niacin
right.
for event reduction.
So retirement for niacin is premature. So
absolutely.
That's not time for a retirement party.
That is nonsense.
So anyway, thank you both very much. This has been an excellent discussion. I think hopefully provided the audience and clinicians out there some take-home points regarding how to interpret this trial most effectively. We think it doesn't change what we do as far as getting to goal. That's still the primary thing. We now know that when someone's already at goal, trying to raise their HDL, at least in this setting with niacin, does not appear to be providing any additional value, at least not in the first 2 to 3 years of treatment.
Right.
So thank you both very much, and
I
want to thank all of you in the audience for tuning in, and I hope to tune in more as more data comes out from future analyses of the AIM-HI trial.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Bill.
Hey, thanks,
Thank
Peter.
You.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME Activity HDL-C and aim high, does increasing HDL-C reduce cardiovascular risk? To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.